Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of reimagineonline.org, sparking the evolution of education choice. On this episode, senior writer Lisa Bowie talks with Nina Reese, president and chief executive officer of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, a national nonprofit organization committed to advancing the charter school movement.
Today, I'm delighted to have Nina Reese, president and CEO of the National Alliance of Public Charter Schools, on our program. The national nonprofit organization's mission is to lead public education to unprecedented levels of academic achievement while fostering a strong charter school movement. Welcome to Podcast Ed, Nina.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. Well, we'll get started. You got some good news. Stanford University Center for Research on Education, also known as CREDO, just came out with its first nationwide study of charter school impact in 10 years. Comparing these results to the earlier studies, it looks like results in the nation's charter schools have gotten stronger as the movement has matured. What do you think are the most important factors that explain this improvement over time?
That's a great question. And the basic answer is that our schools got better. The longer they stayed open, the more time went by, the better these schools became. And what's interesting about the study is that when the first data set came out, I believe in 2015, the numbers did not look very good. And the second data set was also choppy. But this third installment, which was right before the pandemic in 2019, demonstrates that our laws got better from a quality standpoint. Apparently, authorizers did a better job of closing poor performing schools and replicating the effective ones. And at the end of the day, a lot of the schools that launched earlier became stronger as time went on. So if there was ever a doubt as to the effectiveness of charter schools in their ability to close the achievement gap, this study definitely proves that gap can be closed. And it's just a matter of doubling down and investing more in building these great schools in more places.
And I'm joining you from Florida. And one thing that jumps out in the results is the variation from one state to another. For example, New York jumps off the map as a place where charter schools are making a huge positive impact. Florida charter schools appear to have decent results and improved over the past decade, but they're nowhere near the impact of charters in New York. What do you think state policymakers should make of the state-by-state variation?
There was a study out of Florida from an organization a few years ago. It was the first study of its kind that looked at where students ended up and how much they ended up earning after graduating from charter schools. The study was confined to Chicago and the state of Florida, and the first study of its kind demonstrating that the overall income of students who attended charter schools went up, which is tremendous news. Ultimately, if you're designing these schools to improve economic mobility, Florida's charters are demonstrating that they are able to move students up the mobility ladder. And New York City is a smaller unit. I have to see. I don't think we're comparing apples to apples. I think all of these schools are doing unique things to meet their needs of their communities. And some of them are innovating more. And Florida is one of the few states in the country that has a range of options from public to charter to private school choice. And in that respect, if I were to come up with a policy or a law that is an exemplar, I would pick Florida before I picked New York, because you're able to serve more students. And the state of Florida respects families far more than just about any other state in the country when it comes to having the freedom to exercise choice.
Well, I'm glad to know we're doing something right here in the Sunshine State. I wanted to shift gears and talk about a hot topic where the Alliance has been active. Oklahoma recently approved St. Isidore of Seville, the nation's first religious charter school. It was a controversial move, and the Alliance went on record opposing it. Can you explain the reasons why?
The reason we opposed it is because as public schools, we cannot teach religion. Our position was simply in line with what we believe to be constitutional precedent. We don't agree with the attorney's interpretation that past Supreme Court decisions that allow for public funds to go with students to private schools apply in this case, because charter schools are considered public schools.
And why is the Alliance worried about these schools violating the separation between church and state? Because the church leaders argue that public money from Medicare and Medicaid already goes to faith-based hospitals and faith-based social service organizations without any controversy or any issues. What makes a school different?
That's a great question. In fact, public funds follow students to religious-run pre-K programs and to religious higher education institutions. But in our K-12 system, currently public schools cannot proselytize, cannot teach religion. So unless the Supreme Court were to allow for the teaching of religion in public schools, charter schools are not able to teach religion in their settings right now.
Are you concerned that opening the doors to religious charters might just harm the overall charter movement by causing some progressive states like New York or California then to just say, okay, we're not going to have charter schools anymore and just shut down or just stop allowing new charters and it'll stop the growth of charter schools? Is that a concern?
Potentially, but I would also say as an advocate of parental choice, I also believe that most religious schools are after freedom and autonomy to teach in their schools. And the minute you become a religious charter school, you also have to adhere to all the standards-based accountability requirements that a charter school has to adhere to. So if the goal is to expand religious schools, there are other options in the private sector and certainly through ESAs and private choice options that are more attractive to the operators of these religious schools.
The folks with religious charter schools say that would be great, but there are problems in that the ESA money often doesn't cover the cost of educating the child right now. So a lot of families might not choose those schools who want them because they can't afford them with the scholarship. They also say that being a charter school allows them the ability to better serve students with disabilities. What do you have to say to that?
We're getting into the details of ESA laws. Depending on the state that you're in, the amount of funding can be higher. I was just raising a concern that any religious school would have because by accepting public funding and becoming a charter school, you also open the door to other rules and regulations that religious schools tend to not want to invite. But you're bringing up the financial aspects of it, which is why the school is trying to open in Oklahoma, and it remains to be seen if the court system allows for it to actually open. In order for a religious charter school to exist, the Supreme Court needs to decide that charter schools are not state actors, which is a question that they did not pick in the last go-around when a similar case was before them a week or so ago.
And we'll get to that in a minute or two, that court case. The charter school movement historically attracted people, especially those in urban schools that serve low-income children and students of color, kind of a social justice-oriented outlook and fostered that type of culture. With more conservative groups entering the charter space, how do you think a ruling that opens the door to religious charters would affect the movement?
Charter schools from the very beginning have been very diverse. We've had those who were social justice warriors. We've had individuals who were simply interested in innovating in the charter school setting. We've had individuals who wanted to dismantle the traditional public system. So it's not fair to say that the movement was only started by social justice warriors from the very beginning. What was really attractive to me in particular about the movement is the fact that people from the left and the right came together to see if deregulating some of the aspects of public schooling could lead to better achievement and outcomes. And we have proven that. The reason why the traditional system is reacting and the reason why we're getting so much attention and the reason we have so many enemies is because of the impact that we have had. So I don't necessarily think some of the discussions around one religious school in Oklahoma are necessarily going to change anything. These differences in agreement have been around for a long time. We have to keep a wide tent and to make sure that we include as many people in our camp as possible, because ultimately what we're trying to do is meet the unique needs of our students. And so long as families are attracted to our schools and are benefiting from these schools, we shouldn't get too bogged down in what others have to say about the sector.
You basically can coexist with all of the different mindsets and cultures.
We have been coexisting for a long time. This is nothing new.
Moving back to that lower court case, U.S. Supreme Court's recent refusal to take up that North Carolina, it was a dress code case in which the Fourth Circuit had ruled that charter schools are state actors. What do you think that means for the fate of religious charter schools? And do you think that's limited only to North Carolina?
The issue with that case was that the school leader was arguing that his students did not qualify as public school students under the federal constitution, and they didn't have the protections that come along with being a public school under the federal constitution. And by making that case, he was trying to open the door to being labeled as a private entity rather than a state actor. So as you noted, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to take the case, which means that the lower court ruling, which deems us state actors, stands. You are not going to be able to have a religious charter school in Oklahoma right now. So unless another court rules differently and the Supreme Court ultimately takes up this case, right now, the laws of the land are written in such a way that we are considered state actors and have the same protections that public school students have.
Okay, well, litigation is promised, so we'll see how that turns out. Pivoting a little bit, the alliance sparred with the Biden administration after it proposed to restrict funding for the federal charter schools program. But you were on the same side in this legal dispute over whether charters should be considered public schools. Do you think the administration is going to support the long-term health of the charter school movement?
For better or for worse, our education system is highly localized. Most decisions are made at the state and local level. They're not made at the federal level. So one administration cannot single-handedly undermine charter schools or any education policy. This administration has not been as vocal of a supporter of charter schools, and their attempt last year to regulate the program centered, quite frankly, around ways to make the program operate better. Also, what happens sometimes when bureaucrats get involved in a lot of decision-making usually is best left in the control of states and localities. So I wouldn't read too much into this administration's posturing. I think at the end of the day, they have supported funding for the charter schools program in their budget every year, albeit it's level funding. And they have certainly supported other efforts at making sure charters qualify for other federal streams of funding. But their agenda is not focused on innovation and certainly not on charter schools. And to me, that is more concerning than this particular fight last year for the charter schools program. Because at the end of the day, if you're trying to solve anything in this country, whether it's economic mobility, healthcare, anything related to the well-being of this country is rooted in a strong education system. And if you're not dealing with how to solve some of the problems in our schools early on, then you're ultimately going to have to fill the gaps later in life. And that's unfortunately the way we've always operated. And unfortunately, this is the issue right now in a lot of states as well. People are distracted with immediate issues rather than some of the more long-term fundamental issues that can be solved with some early investments, but also with some policies that would place a premium on quality and a premium on getting things done, results, which charter schools are very good at delivering.
There will almost certainly be litigation following that Oklahoma decision. What role, if any, will the alliance play in that?
As I've said, we know for a fact that charter schools as public schools cannot teach religion. So we are going to continue monitoring the case and stand ready to help the local sector in its posturing and its defense. We've always been a partner to our state association partners, and we'll continue to do that.
Does that look like signing on as a plaintiff or maybe filing friend of the court briefs, or what might be possible?
Probably an amicus brief. We also filed an amicus brief in the Peltier case in North Carolina.
From the beginning, the charter movement's been, like you said, very ideologically diverse, but it feels like in 2023, it's gotten harder than ever to hold a bipartisan coalition together. Is this dispute over the religious charter schools a sign of a deeper ideological divide within the movement? And how do you plan to keep the movement united moving forward?
Not necessarily. I think what's happened is that the coalition that came together to create charter schools was a very centrist coalition comprised of moderate Republicans and Democrats who wanted to do something different in service to expanding parental choice, but also improving student outcomes, especially in those settings where the public school system had failed for several years. What's happened eventually is that both parties are pulling to the left and the right far more than ever before. So those centrist Republicans and Democrats are not as popular and as involved as they once were in shaping policy. But what we know from polls and from public opinion data is that people ultimately want to govern from the center. So the posturing people take when they run for office is often different from what they need to do in order to get things done. And one of the things that I'm usually very dismayed by is 9 times out of 10, there are a lot of positive things that happen in Washington, D.C., in the halls of Congress. There are a lot of relationships that have been built over time, but the media usually only focuses on the fights that they have. And the more you do that, it could also be a symptom of where the country is. But I think because the media is so focused on getting hits, since there are so many different ways of capturing news these days, that some of the good things that happen behind closed doors often doesn't get noticed. So when it comes to China policy, we have to be careful. But right now we have a good, strong body of Democrats and Republicans in the House and the Senate who have been continuously supportive of increasing funding for the charter schools program. We now have governors in Governor Hochul and Governor Shapiro in Pennsylvania, Governor Green from Hawaii, Governor Polis in Colorado. These are Democrat governors who are supportive of charter schools. We also have a good number of Republicans who are supportive of charter schools. I think the fundamental issue and the problem is that people are just not talking about education and innovation and leveraging what charters can do to really innovate at a time of crisis post-pandemic. I think that's really more of a question than ever before. And in some cases, it's because people are worried about trauma and the learning gap. Certainly, there's a lot of attention on supporting high-quality tutoring so that kids can catch up. So these things are taking center stage over some of the more fundamental questions that we believe need to also happen at the same time in order to make sure that the system is operating in a more nimble and responsive way going forward.
Yeah, you mentioned all the governors, and that brings to mind that charter laws vary across states. What are the advantages and disadvantages of a patchwork system of laws across the country?
The advantage is that people are creating laws that fit their needs. And if something doesn't happen in Oklahoma, it doesn't impact what's happening in New York. So to me, the diversity of the sector is actually one of our greatest assets. And it's important, in my opinion, to keep this system as diverse as possible and to not make it look like every other school out there. The reason a lot of people started charter schools was to break away from the one-size-fits-all regimented district-run systems that start with one curriculum, one process to buy paper, and all these things that ultimately stifle the ability of a teacher to really run their classroom to meet the needs of students. The diversity doesn't bother me, but I do think at the end of the day, most of these states would be well served if they did two things better. One of them is to close the gap between how much goes to charter schools and how much goes to public schools. There's a great study out of the University of Arkansas that highlights we have a 30-cent on the dollar gap right now that needs to be closed. And the other is access to facilities. 30 years ago, when chartering was first conceptualized, it was fair to say you're just an experiment. You shouldn't have access or control over your building. But 30 years into it, the fact that our operators still have to hustle for money, often private dollars, to buy that building is a shame, because no student can attend a school without a building. And those buildings need to be the best state-of-the-art buildings possible, because you're ultimately trying to show them what it's like to attend a high-quality school comparable to a lot of the schools that affluent families send their kids to.
Well, Florida recently passed legislation requiring districts to share some of their facility funds. Is that the norm in most states or not? Or is Florida ahead of its time in passing that legislation?
So there are a lot of cities, and you mentioned New York City has a law that requires that the city share space or give public space to charter schools that are oversubscribed or need a facility. In Washington, D.C., the mayor has to make public schools available to charter schools if they have the space in these public schools before they bid out that space to others. So we have had laws like this in other places. I will just say that in D.C., for instance, there are a lot of games that are played at the local level that prohibit charter schools from accessing those buildings. So kudos to Florida for putting this in place. But I think ultimately how these laws are being implemented is just as important as passing.
It's been so great to have you. Is there anything as we wrap up that you would like to share? Any new news from the Alliance? Any news about the future of charter schools you can tell us about?
We did a sneak peek of this poll, and the larger poll is going to come out in a couple of weeks by the Harris poll. It's a poll on teachers And what's great about it is that it demonstrates that our teachers are no different than other public school teachers in terms of wanting to just teach in the classroom. They don't like all the polarization. They don't like the culture wars that are taking place. So in that sense, teachers are teachers, and it's great to see a sense of unity and affinity with all the teachers in the public school system. What's interesting, though, about our poll is that it also demonstrates that those teachers who are teaching in charter schools are happier. Again, more schools of choice. No one's forcing you to go to a charter school. So in that sense, I am not super surprised. What's surprising to me is that despite all the fatigue and angst out there, the teachers in charter schools seem to be even more committed to teaching in charter schools than they were before. There are a lot of good nuggets in the poll. Once the full report is released, hopefully you'll invite us back to also talk about it. But it's a way for us to demonstrate the value of charter schools. We often talk about charter schools in the context of attracting families to them, but this poll demonstrates that charter schools are also a good bet for teachers. And the 240,000 some odd teachers who teach in our schools are the reason we are successful. And I hope that this poll and other polls like it can open the door to more teachers to come to our schools or to try to open charter schools.